And it's from the Gospel of John, chapter 13, starting at verse 18. I am not referring to all of you. I know those I have chosen, but this is to fulfill this passage of Scripture. He who shared my bread has turned against me. I am telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am who I am. Very truly, I tell you, whoever accepts anyone I send accepts me, and whoever accepts me accepts the one who sent me. After he had said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit and testified, "Very truly, I tell you, one of you is going to betray me." His disciples stared at one another, at a loss to know which of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said, "Ask him which one he means." Leaning back against Jesus, he asked him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is the one to whom I give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish. Then, dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And as soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. So Jesus told him, "What you are about to do, do quickly." But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the festival or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. When he was gone, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now. Where I am going, you cannot come. A new command I give you: love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. But this everyone will know, by this everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus replied, "Where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." Peter asked, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Then Jesus answered, "Will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the cock crows, you will disown me three times."
There's a lot more we could say about the second half of John chapter 13. I want to focus just today on one verse, which we call the new commandment, and you find it in verse 34. "A new command I give you: love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." We may come back to the rest of the chapter in a couple of weeks when I'm here again on April the whatever it is. John chapter 13, John 13 to 17, it's been called the Holy of Holies of the New Testament. It's Jesus' last night on earth with his disciples, the people he calls his own, who were in the world. He's leaving them in the world to carry on his mission to the world. And as we saw last week, he washes their feet. He gives them an example to follow. He models the Christian lifestyle. Chapters 14 to 16, and also a little bit at the end of chapter 13, which we're looking at today, he teaches his disciples And then chapter 17, he prays for his disciples. So he models or gives an example to his disciples. He teaches his disciples and he prays for his disciples. And that's the three-part job description of any pastor: to be an example to the flock, to teach the people, and to pray for the people. That's what pastors do. If that's all they do, that's fine. That's what they're supposed to do. I want to focus now on the teaching, which actually begins here at the end of chapter 13. And I want us to look at this, what Jesus calls this new command, or this new commandment. Jesus is leaving his disciples. There are some things he wants to tell them before he goes, some important things to tell them before he goes, things that he wants them to remember. And the first thing he wants them to remember is what he calls this new command: love one another as I have loved you. That's his parting wish. Actually, it's not a parting wish. It's a parting command. It is his final instruction to his disciples. A new commandment I give you: love one another as I have loved you. So I want to begin by looking at the meaning of love in the New Testament. What does love mean in the New Testament? If it's Jesus' parting command, and if it's the distinguishing mark of a Christian, by which everybody knows that we're his disciple, we need to know what it is we're talking about. And the Christian view of love, the New Testament view of love, is totally different from many popular ideas about love in the world. I mean, one popular view of love in the world is that it's a feeling of attraction. You feel attracted to something or someone. It can be just about anything. You can even get car stickers with "I love" dot, dot, dot on. "I love Carlisle United." You can actually get stickers with that on. "I love Carlisle United." "I love surfing." "I love cats." And for some reason, some people just feel an attraction to certain things. And romantic love is when you feel that attraction for a particular person, and when that particular person feels the same attraction for you, then you've got romantic love. And it's not something you can do much about. It's something you fall into. You fall in love. And you can't do much about it. It's, you know, people talk about the chemistry these days. The chemistry was there. The chemistry was right. Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger across a crowded room. And somehow you know even then that somehow you'll see her again and again. Who can explain it? Who can ever try? Fools give you reasons. Wise men never try. So it's totally irrational. You don't explain it. It just happens. It's just the chemistry. You've fallen into it. The feeling just comes over you. The problem is, what happens when, after you marry that person, the enchanted feelings wear off? And what happens if, on some other enchanted evening, you see another stranger? And the whole thing starts off again. Well, one thing you mustn't do nowadays, one thing you must not do nowadays, is stifle your feelings, deny your feelings. You must be true to yourself. So even though you've promised to love your wife or your husband until one of you dies, well, now that promise doesn't mean a thing. And you've got an affair, or a divorce. That is one view of love in the modern world. It's a very popular view, and you find it in the songs and so on that we are faced with constantly. And it bears no resemblance whatever to what the New Testament means by love. It's a totally different thing. I'm not saying that's all the world ever means by love. We've recently had an example in France of a policeman who swapped with a hostage and got killed. But you know how a lot of modern scientists explain what they call altruism, selfless love. They say, we do that because one day we'll want people to do it to us. One day we'll need something from somebody else. So, to make sure that we get something we need from somebody else, now we give to somebody else what they need, and so it goes on. But it's actually all completely selfish. Not love at all. It's selfish. And that's how the human race, and whatever was before the human race, came to see that, you know, it's best way to behave like that. So that's another modern view of love. Now, I don't want to argue that feelings are absent from Christian love. Not at all. I just want to argue that that's not where the primary emphasis is. In the New Testament, love is not primarily a feeling. It is primarily an activity. And that's why here, Jesus commands us. He commands us to love one another. Now, you can't command a feeling. You can't command a person to feel love for Carlisle United. I mean, they may love Hartlepool. Actually, our Hartlepool supporter isn't here, sadly. I've been saving that up all week for him. You may be attracted to Hartlepool United, not Carlisle United, or even Morecambe. I see over there. So you can't command a person to have a feeling, to have an attraction to something that he hasn't got. If your child doesn't like Brussels sprouts, it's no use commanding him to like Brussels sprouts. You can command him to eat them. It's not a good idea, probably, but you can command him to eat them, but you can't command him to feel attracted to them or to love them. But here Jesus commands us to love one another. And that's why in the marriage service, incidentally, we promise to love each other. You can't promise to have a feeling. The feeling may be there one day. It may not be there another day. But in the marriage service, we promise to love one another. So love must be an activity that we either choose to do or not to do. It's not just a feeling that we either have or don't have. And we promise to do it for better or worse until we are parted by death. That is what we promise to do when we get married. Can I just remind you about that? Everybody. That's what we promise to do when we get married. So young people who aren't married yet, make sure you don't rush into it. Make sure you've got somebody who you're happy to promise that you're going to love until you die or until they die. So love is an activity primarily, not a feeling. Titus chapter 2 verse 4, Paul says to Titus, teach the older women to teach the younger women to love their husband. So loving your husband is something you can learn how to do. Imagine that. Imagine a pop song about that. Learning how to love your husband. Okay, so it's an activity. So what kind of activity is it? Well, it is activity aimed at the good or the well-being of other people. It is meeting the needs of other people. It's caring for others. It is other person-centeredness. It's valuing and respecting other people because they're created in the image of God, regardless of whether that image has been distorted or defaced. One writer has defined it as a passionate desire for the well-being of others, regardless of whether or not they deserve it. A passionate desire for the well-being of others, regardless of whether or not they deserve it. So it's not getting for myself from others, it's giving myself to others. It's spending energy, strength, time, money, my life for others. It is self-denying, it's self-giving. You don't love another person because you like to control people, because you like to feel important, because you like to feel needed, because you're bossy. You do it genuinely because you care for the other person. It's a very rare thing. An act of pure, selfless love is a very, very rare thing. So that's the meaning of love. Secondly, the model of love. Love one another, the commandment is, the new commandment, as I have loved you. Now, why does Jesus call the commandment to love a new commandment? I mean, the commandment to love our neighbor goes back as far as Leviticus in the Old Testament. It's there in Leviticus. And Jesus summarized the whole of the Old Testament law as loving God and loving our neighbor as ourselves. So there's nothing new about the command to love. But Jesus calls this a new commandment. There is a new dimension to this commandment. And I think it must be that we are to love one another as Jesus has loved us. That's what makes this commandment new. So we need to ask the question, how has Christ loved us? John has just described the washing of the disciples' feet. And at the beginning of the chapter, he said that was an example of love. He loved his own. He loved them to the end. And he begins by a description of Jesus washing their feet. And Jesus says, this is a model for you to follow. It's an example for you to follow. So what is the love of Christ like? It is humble, demanding, demeaning, unspectacular service, even for those we know are going to let us down, like Judas or Peter or the rest of the 12. And we saw last week that the washing of the feet was actually a foreshadowing. It was a kind of dramatic acted parable of a much greater and costlier act of humility and loving service. It was an acted parable of Jesus' death. Jesus got up from the meal and returned to the meal. And if you read John's Gospel, you'll be familiar with those verbs. Jesus came from the Father, and he was returning to the Father, and he came from the Father to do something for us. And what he did, without any shadow of doubt, was an act of love. And in chapter 15, Jesus says to these same disciples, greater love has no one than this, that a man or a woman should lay down his or her life for his or her friend. So, Jesus' death is his supreme act of love. And John in his first letter will say, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. He goes on to say, if anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on him, how can the love of God live in that person? So the love of Jesus' love is very wonderful. It is a sacrificing, serving, compassionate, giving, forgiving, generous, undeserved love. And Jesus has the new commandment that he's leaving with his disciples on his last night on earth is that we are to love one another like that. I want to say something thirdly about the motivation for love. The meaning of love, the model for love, the motivation for love. The discerning amongst you will have noticed that all three of those words begin with the letter M. The motivation of love. I have loved you. Yes, I've just said it's the model for our love. But it's more than the model, it's the motivation for Christian love. It's the stimulus for Christian love. Why should anyone behave like this? And we've only got one life. Why should we give it for other people? Why should we give our lives for others? Why should we give ourselves up for the good of others? Is it just a model? Is it just an example for me to follow? So is it just a question of me gritting my teeth and forcing myself to follow Jesus' wonderful example of amazing love? Well, that would be like me regularly trying to follow Mary Berry's example and cook a meal. And it rarely comes out like it does when she does it. For some reason. It'd be like me reading a biography of Josh Naylor. If you don't know who Josh Naylor is, Andrew will tell you. He is a legendary Cumbrian fell runner. And he's older than me. He's probably in his 70s now. And he's probably still running up most of the fells in the Lake District every morning before his breakfast. And, you know, I could say, right, that's a good idea. It's about time I did something like that. And I could try to follow Josh Naylor's example. Don't know that it would work very well. I think the mountain rescue would be out fairly quickly. So, is it just a question of us trying to follow Jesus' spectacular example of love? And the answer to that question is definitely not. In fact, we can't begin to love like this unless we know that we are loved like this. Love one another as I have loved you. I have loved you. Look at what I've just done for you. Washed your feet. Look at what I'm going to do for you tomorrow. Give my life for you. That is why you are to love one another, because I have loved you. So it's never a question of, I must try and love like Jesus, because that will get his approval. And if I try hard enough, then he will probably like me a little bit more. And he might even get to love me. We Christians don't live their lives to gain assurance or confidence of Christ's love and to make their salvation secure. That is not Christianity. Millions of people think it is. But it's got nothing to do with Christianity. Christians love not to be loved by God, but because they are loved by God and they know it. Even though they're totally unworthy and undeserving. I meet monthly with a group of unbelievers, mainly unbelievers. You don't have to be an unbeliever to be in the group, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to join. But it just happened to be mainly unbelievers, and most of them are atheists, actually. It's a philosophy group. And I joined just so I could get to know them. And at the last meeting, one of them said this. This is what one of them said. He said that atheists are much better people than Christians. Why? Well, he said, because we live good, generous lives, just as good and just as generous as you Christians. We live good, generous lives with no hope of reward at all. We don't believe in heaven or hell, but we still lead good, generous lives. You Christians live good life for completely selfish reasons, to avoid judgment, to get a reward in heaven. Nothing to do with Christianity. That is nothing to do with Christianity. Christians love not to be loved by God because they are loved by God. Even though we're totally unworthy and totally undeserving. And it's only when we understand that, when, as Heather mentioned in her prayer this morning, it's only when we understand the length and the breadth and the depth and the height of Christ's love for us that we will even begin to love other people. We're not trying to earn anything at all. We're just trying to reflect what God has given us in his amazing grace and generosity. And God so loved the world, he gave his only Son to take our humanity, to take our human weakness upon himself, to take our frailty, to take our death. God's Son became a servant and died the worst death imaginable. It was the worst death the Romans could devise. And he died it. For every human being who will turn to him. And it's only when we've seen and experienced love like that that we will begin to love other people. And it's interesting, isn't it? And I only discovered this last night, actually. It's interesting that from this point on in the gospel, not before this, I don't think, I didn't have time to check it out, but from this point on in John's gospel, he starts describing himself as the disciple Jesus loved. I'm the disciple Jesus loved. Isn't that amazing? And it's only when you understand that you are the disciple Jesus loved that you will begin to love other people as Christ has loved you. It's only when the Holy Spirit, in other words, opens our eyes and opens our hearts to the love of Jesus and pours that love into our hearts, it's only then that we'll be able to forget ourselves and forget all that we're doing and stop proving ourselves, and we'll be free to bless others and to serve others. That's Christianity. That is the Christian faith. Why do we forgive one another? Paul says, well, because as God forgave us in Christ. Why do we serve one another? Because God, Jesus, became a servant. Why do we esteem others as better than ourselves? Because that's what Jesus did, Philippians chapter 2. Why do we give generously to Christians in poorer countries who are undergoing famine, like the Christians in Jerusalem who were particularly poor in New Testament times because of persecution and famine. And Paul's letters are full of giving to other churches that are going through the mill. Why? Thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift. That's how he gave to us. Why do we impoverish ourselves in order to enrich others? You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor, so that we through his poverty might become rich. We're just doing what he did. He did for us. I've got a section here on the priority of love. I might just miss it out because it's nearly 11:30. I was going to talk about, it's always dangerous to tell people what you were going to talk about. I was going to mention 1 Corinthians 13, and actually the word priority doesn't begin with M, which is another reason for missing it out. It's untidy. The priority of love, and Paul Paul in 1 Corinthians, he emphasizes this in 1 Corinthians. He's talking to a church which is falling out about loads of stuff. One of the things it's falling out about is spiritual gifts. I don't know whether you've noticed, but churches still fall out about spiritual gifts. That's the context of 1 Corinthians 13. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, it doesn't matter what your spiritual gifts are, even if you've got supernatural speaking gifts, which the Corinthians seem to particularly value, like tongues and prophecy, you're just a noisy cacophony. You're just a clanging cymbal or a resounding gong without love. And then more respectable spiritual gifts that we would be more interested in. Understanding all mysteries and all knowledge. Paul says, rubbish, nothing, absolutely nothing without love. Knowledge puffs up. Love builds up. 1 Corinthians 8, I think it is. And so he goes on, he said, it doesn't matter what you do, if it's not an act of love, it's nothing. He doesn't just say it's not as valuable as it might be. He says it's nothing. Nothing. Without love. And then he goes on to say there are three basic Christian qualities, faith, hope, and love. And he says the greatest of these is love. Why? It's not that faith and hope are not essential. They are essential. They're just as essential as love. You can't be a Christian without faith. You can't be a Christian without hope. So why does Paul say that the greatest of these three is love? Well, I can think of two possible reasons. If anybody else can think of any other reasons, let me know. I'm always interested to learn more. First, love endures forever. Faith doesn't endure forever. Faith will become sight, Paul says, somewhere. Hope doesn't endure forever. One day it's going to be fulfilled. We'll have it, what we've been hoping for. It'll be ours. But love will endure forever. Jonathan Edwards wrote a book about 1 Corinthians 13, and he called it Heaven, a World of Love. A World of Love. So love endures forever. And the other reason why I think love is the greatest of the three, faith, hope, and love, is because God is love. God isn't faith. He's the object of faith. God isn't hope. He is our hope. But God is love. And therefore, when we love, we're actually doing what God does. We're being like God. We're being like Jesus, which is what it's all about. That's what the whole thing is about, being conformed to the image of Christ. So Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, live a life of love just as Christ loved you and gave his life for you. An offering and a sacrifice, a fragrant offering and a sacrifice to God. And the final point was that love is the mark of Jesus' disciples, the mark of Jesus' disciples. So we've managed to get back to the letter M. I did, when Hannah emailed me about the content of the sermon so she could do the same thing downstairs, I did ask her to think of another word for priority beginning with M, but she couldn't think of one either. The mark of Jesus' disciple. Jesus said, by this all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. In other words, the distinguishing mark of Jesus' disciples is this kind of love. We're so familiar with this that we miss the power of it. And how do you tell who is a Christian and who isn't? That's what Jesus is talking about here. How do you tell who is a Christian and who isn't? How do you tell what's silver and what isn't, or what's really good silver and what's rubbish? Well, you look for the hallmark. An expert will screw his eyepiece into his eye and he'll peer through it until he's read the hallmark, and then he knows what it is. He knows whether it's genuine or not, or how genuine it is. I mean, two pieces of silver might be almost indistinguishable until the expert looks at the hallmark. It's the trademark of Jesus' disciples. How do you know that your cornflakes are Kellogg's and not the supermarket's own brand, which are probably actually just as good? You look for the big letter K, the big red letter K. And when you see that big red letter K, you know it's Kellogg's cornflake. How do you tell who the disciples of Jesus are? By the way, we love one another as Christ has loved us. In the ancient world, all kinds of people had disciples, philosophers, rabbis. They had young men who attached themselves to a teacher that they admired, not just to get theoretical teaching, not just to take notes in lecture, but to copy a way of life. And then to pass that way of life on to their disciple in turn. So Plato, the Greek philosopher, had a group of disciples. It's said that Plato walked with a stoop. I mean, he was a philosopher. He had a head full of knowledge. So he had to walk with a stoop. His brain was so full. And apparently all his... You can tell the disciples of Plato because they all had exactly the same walk. And it's the same with rabbis like Hillel or Shammai or Gamaliel. And that's what Jesus' disciples were for. They lived in close proximity for 3 years to Jesus. They watched how he dealt with situations, how he dealt with problems, as well as just listening to his teaching, which of course was important as well. That's what Jesus meant when he said to his disciples, "Follow me." He meant it literally, "Follow me." And this is what he was after in his disciple, loving one another as I have loved you. And when the world sees that, it will see genuine Christianity. And the implication is that it might be interested once the world sees that. It might actually be interested. I mean, why say it? Why say that otherwise? By this all men will know that you are my disciples. If you have loved one another, what's the point of saying that? Unless the implication is, yeah, and they might actually believe in me once they see love like that. Once they see a community like that, once they see a church like that, they might actually be interested. They're not interested at the moment in this country. You know that between 40 and 50% of the young people in this country think that Christianity is harmful. They're going to be the leaders in the next generation. The next generation is going to be worse than this one. It's going to be led by people, and it already is to a great degree, but even more in the days to come, it's going to be led by people who actually think that Christianity is harmful. Well, we've got to show them that it isn't harmful. And the way we show them that it isn't harmful is the way we love one another as Christ loved us. That's not harmful, is it? And until we do that, our evangelism may be ineffective. In fact, Jesus says in chapter 17 to his Father, "May they be one as we are one, so that the world might believe that you have sent me." Is there any wonder the world doesn't believe? When we see other churches as a competition. Bible-believing churches sometimes. The competition. Is it any wonder that the world doesn't believe? I know churches where people have been at each other's throats for years. I know Christians personally, or professing Christians. I know Christians, professing Christians personally, who have spent the last 30 or 40 years of their lives making life a misery for the church that they've been in, particularly the church leaders they've been in. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a Christian life, if I can call it a Christian. Well, it's not a Christian life. It's a terrible thing when an ugly community preaches a lovely gospel. A lovely gospel must be proclaimed by a lovely community that not only gives out, but lives out the gospel it preaches. No one has ever seen God, says John. No one has ever seen God. But if we love one another, God lives in us and we in him. And the world will not only hear about God, it will see the love of God in action when the gospel is preached, the love of Jesus is preached by disciples who love one another as Christ has loved them. So may God help us to do that. Amen.